A big chunk of our lives is spent communicating. Some of it in meetings, some of it one-to-one, but a lot of our communication is written. You know, reports, proposals, documentation, blogs, emails, even tweets can take up valuable brain space, especially if your subject matter experts aren't the best communicators. You've got time-consuming proofreading, revisions, and edits. It all adds time and cost to getting our ideas onto paper. According to data from the 2023 State of Business Communications Report, miscommunication costs business in the US an estimated $12,000 per employee per year. I'm willing to bet that number's slightly understated. And with the volume of written communications expected to grow by 18%, according to the same report, that's an expensive problem that's only going to grow. The problem is, of course, that these things don't write themselves. Or do they? Generative AI is something we've spoken about on the show a few times. It's basically software that's capable of mimicking a human's ability to produce content, whether that's text, images, or audio. And it's rapidly changing the way people and businesses create content. One of the world's experts in the field is from a company I suspect you've heard of. But before the big reveal, please check out the show's sponsor, Rocket Software, at rocketsoftware.com to see why over 10 million IT professionals rely on Rocket Software every day to run their most critical business applications, processes, and data. I'm your host, Paul Muller, and today's guest is Rahul Roy-Chowdhury, the Global Head of Product and incoming CEO of Grammarly, an AI-enabled communications assistance company that's used by more than 50,000 teams and 30 million people every day to communicate more effectively everywhere they write. Prior to Grammarly, Rahul worked at a little company you might have heard of, Google, for 14 years, where he led the privacy, safety, and security teams to unify solutions across its product portfolio. And before that, he led the product management teams for the Chrome browser and Chrome OS. Please welcome to the show, Rahul.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me, Paul.
It's fabulous to have you here. That's a heck of a CV you've got.
I appreciate it. I've had a front row seat to some interesting technical changes over the last couple of decades. I feel very privileged.
I don't doubt it. We'll get into your background in just a second. But before we do, we've got something of a tradition on the show. We call the lightning round, a chance to limber up your cerebral matter and get to know you through a slightly quirky lens. You ready to do this?
We'll find out. Let's do it.
All right. First question I ask everyone who's ever been on the show. What would people say is your superpower, Rahul?
Good question. I would say that perhaps bringing order from chaos or extracting signal from noise.
I like that. When did you figure out that was your superpower?
You know, I've worked in areas where there's a lot of stuff happening. There's always a lot of distractions. And so really honing in on what is really important has been something that has helped me in building great products that people find value from. So I've kind of learned this over the course of my career.
I love it. All right, next question. The most disruptive technology of all time.
Well, that's got to be AI. You know, technology has always caused a lot of disruption, you know, starting from Luddites back in the day to bank tellers getting unhappy about ATM deployments. And we always found a way to move beyond it and reinvent ourselves. And we're in the middle of, I would say, probably the most disruptive wave. And I think there's a ton of opportunity, but also we need to proceed with care.
Yeah, we'll dig into that in just a minute. I guess it's the topic of today's discussion. All right, next question. The best quality a leader can have.
I think from my perspective, it's empathy. There's always different viewpoints, different perspectives that go into making a good decision when there's when it's hard and there's no clear path forward. You also want to understand what your users and your customers' needs are. And you put all that together to find a path forward with so much different viewpoints and different perspectives. Empathy is really, I think, the critical unlock.
Your advice to people starting their careers?
Advice to people starting their careers. You know, what I would tell folks, and I would tell a younger me, is focus on your strengths, focus on your passions, focus on what really matters to you. Don't worry so much about how it looks on your resume or, you know, building a career to please someone else's perspective on what you think is right. But just do the thing that actually you know you want to do and that makes you happy and gives you a sense of satisfaction. Ultimately, that is the path to success.
I meet a lot of young people who would say they don't know what their strengths are and they aren't even sure what they're passionate about. I mean, they know what they're passionate about. It might be playing video games, or it might be music, or it might be, you know, riding their jet ski on the weekend. I don't know. But from a career standpoint, they're not sure what they're passionate about, especially at those early days of university where they're trying to kind of pick their major, or they've just graduated and they're not sort of – what would you say to people who are at that point where they're not even sure what their strengths are?
Yeah, I'd say a couple of things. One is, you know, don't be afraid to take chances and don't be afraid to fail as you discover your passions. It is a journey. There is no right answer. It's kind of a lifelong journey to figure out the thing that makes you tick, that makes you happy. And so there's things you can do. Like, for example, one of the things I tell folks often is reflect back on your last week. Just think back, you know, just go maybe look at your calendar if you have one and think about how you spent time that week and think about the moments that made you happy, the moments that where you felt like you were in a flow state. And think about the moments where your energy was kind of depleted because you were doing something that didn't give you that kind of rush and jolt of energy. And so sometimes even just reflecting back can give you clues into the things that actually make you tick as a person and as a professional.
I think that's brilliant. We actually did a podcast with Paul Gervais last week on the topic of flow and flow states and getting to flow states. So a great segue. Thank you for that. Oh, the check's in the mail.
All right.
I love that. The first thought that comes to mind when you think of communication.
The word that pops in my head is essential. I think communication is such an essential part of who we are as humans, as individuals, in our professional lives, in our personal lives. And I think we, as a species, I think we tend to overestimate our ability to communicate effectively, and we underestimate the importance of communicating effectively. And so it's essential. And so that's the word.
I love that. We're going to get into this in a little longer, so I'll hold off my comments on that one. Last question from the lightning round. If you could use technology to solve one world problem, what would it be and why?
Well, I got to say, I think climate change and dealing with the effects of climate change is the problem of our times. And I think technology can offer viable solutions, because the reality that, as I see it, is no matter what we do in the future, we're already in the era of adaptation. We have to adapt to pretty large changes in our environment around us. And so we need to be able to leverage technology to help us with this future. No matter what the spectrum of outcomes are, adaptation is certainly in our future, and we need to use technology to solve it.
It's a big problem. All right, well, let's jump off that slightly somber note and let's talk a bit about you, and we're going to talk about communication. But before we do, I'm just fascinated by your background. We were talking a little bit before the show. I mentioned to my family that I had the CEO of Grammarly, or the incoming CEO of Grammarly, coming on the show, and everyone was like, oh my gosh, Grammarly, I love that stuff. How did you find yourself in this position?
Yeah, it's funny you say that, actually, because I've been at Grammarly about 2 years now. As you mentioned, I run the product team, and I'm very honored and humbled that I'm going to be the next CEO of Grammarly in just a very short period of time. But in the time that I've been here, these last 2 years, I get maybe 3 or 4 messages from people just letting me know that Grammarly has had a huge impact in their lives. And it's so gratifying and it's so wonderful. This is why we do what we do. This is what gets me out of bed every morning. To your comment earlier about, you know, how do you find your path? How do you find what gives you energy? Finding a way that the work I do impacts people in the world, it gives me a ton of energy. And so that's how I found my way to Grammarly. When I saw the mission and I saw the impact it had on people, I just wanted to be a part of it. And I'm very grateful that 2 years later, here I am charting the course for the next chapter of Grammarly's future.
Yeah, it's a very humanistic technology when you think about what it does. I mean, it communicates, it helps us communicate better. So I suppose it touches all of us where we live. How did you find yourself in this position? Tell us a bit about your background. You're an engineer by training?
Yeah, that's right. I started my career, I was going to be an academic. I was enrolled in a PhD program in artificial intelligence way back before it was cool. And so it's a really interesting homecoming for me in some ways to be leading a company that is on the cutting edge of AI, because it's something that's been kind of in the forefront of my mind for many decades now. And so, but I realized that I really care about having an impact and I care about doing things that help people. And so academics was just a little bit too abstract for me personally. And so I ended up joining industry. I worked as a software engineer for a while. Then I moved into product management. I was at Google for many years. I joined Chrome in the early days when it was still the Skunkworks project inside Google. People are like, another browser? Who needs that? And then a decade later, I was running the Chrome team and we had helped billions of people around the world access the web through many changes, through the rise of the smartphone, through the rise of low-cost devices that enabled billions of people to come online for the first time. And so it gave me a good sense of how technology can help people improve their lives and livelihoods. And it's made me a lifelong technology optimist. I see the challenges sometimes that technology causes, including, I'm sure we'll get into the recent AI developments, but at its core, I'm an optimist in terms of technology having a positive impact on people's lives. And I've lived it in my career.
I mean, it's an incredible career story. And I just want to reflect on your comment about the academic side of things, because I remember wandering through an expert systems, if you remember expert systems, which were kind of a kissing cousin of AI back decades ago.
Yeah.
You know, and everyone's programming in Lisp and a lot of in Smalltalk. So there were a lot of these also niche computer programming languages that were being utilized at the time. And I remember we're talking probably 35 years ago now. And it all seemed so sci-fi, and it seemed like that. It reminds me a lot of fusion energy, right? Where it's always 20 years away and always will be, if you've heard that phrase.
Yes.
And it just seems in the last 5 years, we've gone from something that really poorly aped human capability to something that's almost, well, you know, the Turing test now seems redundant. It would fool another person to think they were talking to a real person.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think certainly maybe for folks who are immersed in it, this is not a surprise, but the surprise for me certainly was just understanding data and the statistical properties of data at scale have unlocked these incredible use cases that never would have thought possible. You never would have thought that just a large and complex enough large language model, which in essence is a statistical model of kind of distribution of language over a very large corpus, that leads to all these incredible things we see in all these demos that are seemingly coming out every minute. That's a surprise to me, actually. And all these emergent properties are kind of interesting. But it's great that it's happening, but I wouldn't have expected it, you know, way back when.
It is. So at the risk of losing some of our listeners, because we've gotten a little bit techie and buzzwordy, and that's my fault. My apologies, Rahul. Maybe if you could explain in your words what generative AI is to people.
Yeah, generative AI is using a kind of an interesting innovation in artificial intelligence called large language models and using it to generate text. So the thing that sets apart generative AI from, and the reason for the name is, it's not regurgitating something it's seen before, it's generating something new and novel from what it's seen before. And that's, I think, the essence of what makes this interesting and new.
And when we say new and novel, how much text can something like this generate? I mean, because obviously we've had things like autocomplete on sentences on your phone or your computer for the last couple of years. It generates a word, or at least a choice of words.
Yeah,
we're talking about something more sophisticated than that, though, aren't we?
Something far more sophisticated. You can think in terms of generating, you know, paragraphs, entire documents, multiple pages, and in fact, the pace of change is so rapid here that I think you can just think, if you just play this out over the next year, a couple of years, I can think of this as essentially unlimited in terms of how much it can generate and the scope of what it can generate. And it's not just text, it's video, it's voice, it's images. And so it's all of these things coming together.
We're talking, I mean, literally up to the point where we could create a book or a movie or any of those sorts of things using these sorts of technologies.
Yep.
So incredible. I mean, obviously, back to your point about the Luddites got really concerned that these automated weaving machines would put them out of work. There's a lot of knowledge workers and even people outside of the knowledge work industry, outside of the white collar world, who are thinking the AIs are coming to steal my jobs. We'll talk about that in a second. But before we do, what are some of the ways that things are, I guess, these technologies are changing business for good? What are some of the opportunities that it's creating for businesses?
Yeah, there are a couple of ways to kind of ground the conversation. The first is to recognize that This is a huge issue for businesses today. So for example, a year ago, we did a research exercise where we talked to business leaders across the US to ask them the challenges around communication. And what we found was a couple of interesting data points. Number one, the average knowledge worker in the US spends about half their week, like 20-ish hours a week, just in written communications. And they spend about a day every work week, roughly 8 hours, just dealing with the ill effects of ineffective communication. And if you take that, if you multiply that across all knowledge workers across the US, that's a $1.2 trillion economic deadweight loss every single year, year after year, just in the US alone. This is a huge issue. And in fact, if you look at some of the recent trends that I think predated COVID, but I think that COVID accelerated, were things like the rise of AI-based tooling, which allows us to remove some of the drudgery from the work we do to focus on higher order things, to the rise of distributed work or remote first work. 2 years ago was the first time that more than 50% of knowledge workers in the US spend at least some of their time working remotely. So this is, the world of work has changed. And so this has all made the problem of communicating effectively, which has always been hard, even harder. So the problem is very real, and finding solutions through technology and other means, I think, is a very worthwhile endeavor. So that's kind of the grounding kind of principle that we use at Grammarly, certainly to chart our way forward in this scenario.
And I want to jump in on a topic that somebody actually raised to me yesterday, again, in preparation for this call was or this podcast, was the matter of diversity, equity, and inclusion, because it was my partner that I remember, and she was saying that her friend uses Grammarly every day, and she has challenges with, I mean, I don't know if it would be, if she would describe herself as being dyslexic, but she certainly has trouble gathering her thoughts in a way that are crisp and coherent without a tremendous amount of effort. And so Grammarly is an accelerant for her that effectively allows her to get the great ideas that are in her head and put them onto paper. And my business partner, I think, would probably not mind me saying that he has a mild form of dyslexia. And again, writing for him, he's an amazing thinker, but getting those thoughts through the brain onto the keyboard sometimes takes longer than they'd like. I guess, maybe do you want to reflect on that?
Yeah, it's a really interesting point. You know, we just 2 weeks ago, we announced our take on generative AI. It's a new piece of product functionality we're calling Grammarly Go. And so as we bring this to market, it's going to launch to our users next month. But as we bring it to market, it's something we thought deeply about, because we want to make sure that the brand promise we provide to our users remains true in the face of all these technical changes. So what Grammarly Go does, for example, is it allows you to ideate and co-create along with Grammarly. It allows you to refine and reflect. For example, maybe you have a paragraph of text and you want to make some holistic change to that text. For example, saying, you know, I want this entire text to sound a little less formal, make it more informal. And so with Grammarly Go, you click a button, it gets less formal and you can just adapt the whole thing. Or maybe make it shorter. And with a single click, you can make it shorter. Or if you one of the, my favorite feature of Grammarly Go, as we tested internally, is we're all dealing with the influx of information, email. And with Grammarly Go, we can help provide relevant, timely, authentic responses to the email using the context of the email. So we're launching this thing. We announced it. I was at South by Southwest talking about it last week. And as we work through this launch, exactly the kinds of things you're raising were very top of mind for us in terms of how do we design these things such that people feel like this is an accelerant, that this is something that augments their potential and not something that takes away. So we have a very intentional way that we develop these features. And I can talk more about that, but really my main, you know, what I'll leave you with is the idea of building technology and using AI to augment human potential rather than destabilize human potential or reduce human potential, that doesn't happen by accident. It actually requires intention. And so we make very, very careful design and technical decisions to make sure that we're always on this path of helping users and keeping users in control of the experience.
Yeah, and I suppose it's that also that notion, and I guess I raised this through the lens of looking at it, the diversity side of things, because there's always a little bit that thinks that some of these technologies are cheating, right? I mean, you know, you could use the word inauthentic, but there's a little bit of a cheat there. And it really wasn't until we had the conversation about people, you know, I guess the neurodiverse community, for whom it isn't cheating. It's a way of getting something that's inside their cerebellum.
Yeah.
That is a, you know, is an original coherent thought, and, you know, getting it through whatever's inhibiting that from being received by us as an audience. And I guess I had what I could only describe as ableist guilt. I thought, wow, you know, I hadn't really thought about it through the perspective of people for whom this technology is literally helping release their thoughts from a cage. Is that overstating it, do you think?
Yeah, no, I think it's ideally, this technology enables everyone to get superpowers, because no matter what you're struggling with, in some cases, it's struggling to get the idea from your mind onto a piece of paper. In other cases, it's struggling with something else, maybe synthesizing the information in the right way. But no matter what the challenge is with communicating effectively is just a hard thing for everyone. I think it's not just for a certain segment of people, it's for everyone. And so for us, what is key in Grammarly, how we provide functionality with the new launch of Grammarly Go, it was really about making sure that if we are generating text on your behalf using these large language models, that that text reflects who you are. It's in your voice. It is, you know, it conveys the thing that you want to convey in the way that you feel proud of getting across out there. So, you know, even if you were able to get an idea from paper to document, but it's just boilerplate, you know, you use a large language model and you got generic boilerplate text that everyone else gets, that's not a very satisfying outcome, at least from my perspective. I want text that sounds like me, reflects who I am. And so those are all things that require investment and require thought. It doesn't happen kind of out of the box.
I couldn't agree more. I've a couple of examples I've heard recently of these sorts of technologies being deployed are particularly in marketing. So, you know, generating things like tweets or microblogs or similar sort of content, ad copy. I was speaking to one marketing agency recently. The entire strategy was created by generative AI, and then it was just tweaked a little. What are some of the, I guess, the business value that you're seeing as they're adopting this sort of technology? What sort of value is it creating?
Yeah, I think it's early days, first of all. I think everyone is trying to understand how best to adapt this technology to their business, to their, you know, how they operate, et cetera. So I think it's going to change and evolve as you learn more. But I think that there is so much friction in routine communication. You don't have to go too far afield. Even a simple thing like you're communicating some information over an email, but you're not clear how much context to include. Do I include a lot of context and worry about being too verbose? Do I include too little context and worry about being too inscrutable? And people are like, what is this person saying? And so there's just so many friction points in communicating effectively. So if we can harness this technology to break down those friction points, I think you're going to see a ton of value being created. And so going back to the $1.2 trillion in just economic loss due to ineffective communication, my hope is that companies like Grammarly and many others will actually make a big dent and achieve better outcomes for companies. I think at the end of the day, communication is the lifeblood of companies. This is the world in which we live in. And so the companies that master the art of communicating well, they're the ones that will stand the test of time. And I think the other ones will struggle to adapt to this new reality.
I couldn't agree with you more. With, I suppose, how do we... You mentioned voice, so maybe voice is worth something talking about. So when each of us writes or communicates, we have a certain stylistic set of quirks or ways of communicating that make us uniquely us. I mean, you know, Obama's probably one of my favorite, right? He has a very distinctive way of communicating. And I guess we associate that with authenticity. You mentioned some of these tools can retain our voice. How are they capable of mimicking me when they don't know who I am? And I guess really my bigger question is, how can we use these tools without losing that sense of self? And how close are we to being able to do that?
There are a couple of different ways to answer that question. The first is there are technical ways to try and fine-tune data to understand your preferences, your stylistic choices, and bake that into the output of these models. So we can certainly do that. But actually, I think a bigger and more beneficial way to think about it is something we want to always imbue in our products is user control, user autonomy. We want to make sure users have control and they feel like they're in the driver's seat of this entire experience. So if you look at Grammarly Go, for example, you'll see that user voice and the user deciding how they want to come across in a certain context is core to the experience of Grammarly Go. We want to give users control over that, how they want to come across. And if you look at kind of the design and the user flows, you'll see that what we do is we guide, we prompt, but ultimately we defer to the user to make the right decisions for themselves. And that's not an accident. It actually is a very deliberate design choice, because we want users to always feel that they're in control of the situation. The technology is something they can harness for their ends, and it's not something that's being done to them. And so that is not something, as I mentioned earlier, it does require, you know, design and technical choices that you need to be very careful about how you make as you roll products out to your users.
Well said. I want to change tack a little and talk about the future of work for a bit. You know, there's that famous study that says, you know, the majority of the jobs in 20 years' time won't exist today. How do you see the future of work evolving or adapting the way, and maybe some of the skill sets, and let's even talk about the pedagogical process, the process of teaching, I guess, both the existing workforce, but the incoming workforce, about how to think about leveraging these tools? Because it is an incredible new capability that requires a different, maybe not skill set so much as just a different set of practices and a different mindset. What are your thoughts on that?
I think the promise of this technology is for all of us to A, be kind of freed from the drudgery of just the rote communication tasks we deal with every single day. And so I get a lot of email, some of it is pretty routine responses. And if actually that can be done in a faster, more effective way, I can be more efficient with my time. I mean, I keep hearing about this inbox zero myth. I mean, maybe someone has it. I really need to talk to them, because I struggle with this. We're inundated with information. And so if we can use this technology to help us as knowledge workers, we're getting so much information from so many different places. We're reading documents. We're trying to synthesize the information. And if I can use tech and these technical advances to help me synthesize information better, so I can understand, you know, of all these, the 6-page document that you just read, here are the 3 key insights that you want to take when you write this email follow-up response. Or maybe this long email thread of like 50 responses, large group of people, you know, going back and forth. There are 3 action items assigned to you. So don't lose sight of that. Like, here's what you need to respond to. And just, you know, keep me on track, keep me on the rails, keep me more productive. I think that's a wonderful thing. And it actually frees me up to be creative, to do more, you know, unlock new opportunities that maybe I wouldn't have time to do because I've just been buried in the drudgery of just dealing with just the volume of things I got to deal with. And so, you know, I see this as new opportunities being unlocked for us as knowledge workers.
You read my mind. I was actually going to say, with all of this computer-generated content, who's going to read the content? And the ironic answer is the computers.
Yeah.
You know, at some point in time, we're just steering the computers as they talk to each other. My computer, my AI is going to talk to your AI, and they'll sort the problem out, and we can get on with having lunch.
As long as we can come up with the new ideas and we can come up with the creative solutions, I'm good with that.
Yeah,
I'd absolutely rather automate other things away.
Absolutely. Well, look, with that, I mean, I think, are there any other sort of, from your perspective, any other things that are in the back of your mind as you're thinking about how you, not only how you steer Grammarly, but how society as a whole should be thinking about generative AI? And you're a technology optimist, but maybe some of the things that you've got in the back of your mind that we also need to be anticipating so that we don't wind up in a situation that that we'd maybe later regret.
Yeah. That's a great question. And, actually, at South by Southwest, I gave a talk. The title of the talk was Augmented Intelligence. And I kind of got on my soapbox and I said, I wish AI had a do-over and we could rename AI Augmented Intelligence instead of Artificial Intelligence, because I actually feel like that gets at what we want out of these systems. We want them to help us. Once you look at Artificial Intelligence, you end up in these conversations around consciousness and sentience. And I feel like we lose sight of the key goal we want from these systems, which is to enable us to do our work better. And so augmented intelligence is the mantra we have at Grammarly. And it's actually a challenge to the industry at large to really take a stand in building this technology in a way that augments human potential. I talked about this framework we use inside Grammarly. We call it the TRUE framework. The T is for trust, The R is for responsibility. The U is for user control. And the E is for empathy. And there's kind of details behind it. But it's a way of thinking about building features that take our responsibility to our users very seriously. So what I see often in the conversations is, and you know, this is changing and people are changing and bringing a lot more nuance to it. But what I see in the extremes is there's either the, you know, this is too scary, you got to shut it down. And I'm not a fan of that because I actually think AI adds a huge amount of value in our lives. Or there's the, let's just move forward, innovation at all costs, we'll figure it out later and hope for the best. And hope is not a strategy. And so we need to be more intentional to carve a better path forward. It's not shut it down or run heedlessly forward. And so what does that better path look like? At least our take at Grammarly is the true framework may hopefully help other people as well think through it and think about like what is the right way to bring the fruits of these technical advancements to our users.
Incredibly optimistic, but also incredibly thoughtful. Rahul, it's just been an absolute pleasure having you. Thank you, especially given how busy you are, for taking the time to join us today. It's been
wonderful
stuff.
To be here. Thank you, Paul. Appreciate it.
That's been fabulous stuff. Hey, two last questions for you. First, if people are interested in learning more about generative AI or about how they can augment their intelligence using some of these technologies, where can they go to learn more?
I would say a good place to go is grammarly.com/go. I think that's a great place. This is our recent launch on generative AI. So many of the things that I talked about is very top of mind, and you can see a lot more information on that URL.
Fabulous stuff. And the show sponsor, Rocket Software, big shout out to them. They've got a set of values they talk about that matter to them. Empathy, funnily enough, humanity, trust, and love are just four of their corporate values. What matters to you right now?
What really matters to me is bringing this technology to our users at scale. We have this incredible inflection point in what this technology can enable for people around the world. We need to take that responsibility very seriously and be intentional about how we bring this technology in a way that's safe and reliable and augment human potential. So what really matters to me is I don't want to lose sight of our responsibility in this moment, which is exciting, but at the same time, you know, call on all of us in the tech industry to really heed that imperative to help our users.
Well said. On that very thoughtful note, Rahul, thank you so much for joining us. It's been a great pleasure having you. And thanks again to Rocket Software for bringing us another episode of Digital Disrupted. And thank you again for listening in. If you like what you've heard, please do give us a thumbs up on iTunes or Spotify, wherever you happen to be listening. You can also reach out to me on the Twitter, @XTheStreams, or our show sponsor at Rocket. So if you've got any questions for our guests such as Rahul or ideas for topics you'd like to see covered on future episodes, drop us a line. We'd love to hear from you with that. We'll see you all next week. Stay disruptive, everybody.